What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in-store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, riding along in this big old jet plane, I've been thinking about my home. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we're going to be starting off with a little bit of wonderful retrofuturism from the 1930s.
Yeah, this was something. I read an article in CNN that prompted me to look into this. And it all started with an article that came out in Popular Mechanics in January 1930.
Now, was that Popular Science or Popular Mechanics?
Popular Mechanics.
Okay.
You can actually read the entire issue of January 1930 Popular Mechanics on Google Books. The whole thing is physically scanned in.
There's a whole bunch of those old back issues of that, and it's really fascinating for the advertisements and for the articles.
Well, for one thing, you know, this was a small piece about the future of commercial flight, because commercial flight was pretty young in 1930. There hadn't been a whole lot of it.
Yeah, the Wright brothers, that was only like, what, 1903 or something?
Yeah, and so there were bits of in the article such as, will you plummet from the sky?
Will you?
To which the answer was, maybe.
To be fair, I wonder that every time I get on an airplane.
Yeah, it's.
I understand the physics, and I'm still like, ugh.
Right. The whole.
This seems shoddy.
In defiance of the laws of nature, we will take flight. Well, this article had a tiny paragraph in it that was set aside for a specific subject, and that was this idea of an airport built over the surface of the ocean, specifically several airports, built every 400 miles or so across the Atlantic Ocean between Europe and North America. And the idea was not that planes had to land in order to refuel, although that would definitely be a bonus.
If they could, yeah.
Because they had already done
long, long distance flights before, but more for the comfort of passengers. The amenities aboard early commercial flights were, let's say, even less impressive than flying coach today. Anyway, unless you were rich, in which case you might have all the comforts the wealthy could afford.
Well, then you had a dirigible.
Yes, you weren't so worried about speed. Right. You were worried about luxury. But they wanted to put an airport about every 400 miles across the Atlantic. And it didn't go into a lot of detail about the actual mechanics of such a thing. It did essentially say that these airports wouldn't truly be floating on the ocean. They would be supported by columns that reached all the way down to the sea floor. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the airport itself would remain 80 feet suspended over the surface of the water. So it would appear to float over the ocean.
Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't be, yeah.
But it wouldn't truly be floating. But that's what we're going to talk about today, are floating airports. These, by the way, the ones that were talked about in Popular Mechanics, never happened. Just no one wanted to put down the money, I guess. According to Popular Mechanics, each floating airport would cost about $12 million. So $12 million in 1930 would be about $170 million in today's money.
That's not that much,
which is
really
actually a low estimate compared to some of the other plans that actual humans have actually cooked up.
Right, right. Well, it could very well be that Popular Mechanics was being overly optimistic about the construction costs of such an airport. So it's just one of a few early suggestions for this kind of approach. There was actually another one that came along just a couple of years later.
Yeah, in February 1934 issue of Popular Science, I came across an article called Uncle Sam Asked to Build Floating Ocean Airports. And
it must be terrible when you're an icon and you're not even a real person. And people come to you and like, hey, can you build a floating ocean airport for me?
Build it. Build it for me.
Yeah. I asked Mr. Peanut the other day if they would, you know, co-sign on a home loan. And that was probably unfair of me.
Well, this was about this Canadian inventor and engineer named Edward Robert Armstrong's long running idea for these things called seadromes. And these were truly, as proposed, floating airports. So a seadrome would be a 1,225-foot long landing area and refueling station floating 100 feet above the water on a series of 28 buoyancy tanks that are partially submerged, and it also had ballast there to help prevent it from rocking too much in the waves and stuff like that. And these things would have overnight accommodations, and they'd essentially be run like a ship. Also like a ship, the seadrome would have propellers for self-guided navigation if necessary, though under most circumstances they would remain anchored in place by steel cables, which are attached to a buoy, which is in turn attached to a heavy sunken anchor. And if y'all want to see what a picture of it looks like, I've got a little link here you can take a look at. It looks like those great old retrofuturist illustrations of the, you know, the future. It has great girders and beams and all of that sort of industrial magic that's wonderful. But so what it called for was sort of like you were talking about, a series of stations throughout the Atlantic Ocean. It called for 5 seadromes between the United States and Spain. It's at about at the latitude of Washington, D.C., that would work as refueling stations for transatlantic flights. And the seadromes would each be about 3 hours flight apart from each other. And one of the rationales given in the article, I don't know if there's really all that much to this, but what the article claimed was that planes could transport heavy payloads with greater speed, since the refueling stations would require the planes to carry less fuel in addition to their payloads. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't have to put all the fuel on board that it takes to get across the ocean.
Right.
You could just sort of, you know, fill up 1/5 of the tank each time. But according to this article, the U.S. government was, quote, interested in the proposal, and Armstrong was currently seeking federal funding for the project. Somehow, it just didn't work out. I don't know.
I'm guessing they should have asked someone besides just Uncle Sam.
Right.
Found at least Santa and the Easter Bunny to
right.
get in on it.
Yeah. You know, arguing with a poster just doesn't, and trust me, I've been there. Doesn't really get you anywhere.
Oh, I imagine that in 1934, there were several other things going on in this country other than like a pressing need to get more stops between us and certain parts of Europe.
Uncle Sam had this bizarre plan to build landing strips out of people. He was always saying, I want you to land planes on.
And just a few years later, there'd be plenty of unemployed to use them as ballast. Moving on from gallows humor. These projects didn't work out, but it didn't stop people from thinking about the floating airport concept in general. And in fact, it has, there are going to be so many puns in this, and I apologize, resurfaced many decades later. And you might want to know, like, well, why would anyone be interested in a floating airport in the first place? Like,
build a regular airport.
Yeah, what's the appeal?
Well, I mean, part of this is to think about what is the purpose of an airport. Obviously, it's to land planes, but you can't land a plane just anywhere.
Right.
You want to land it closer to the destinations where people want to go. So land scarcity and local land scarcity matters. And
sure.
It's not that there's not enough land on Earth to land airplanes on, that in many cases there's not enough flat, stable real estate near the big population center where people are trying to get to.
No one is saying that New York State does not have enough land in it, but the Isle of Manhattan specifically is not large.
It's pretty jam-packed with stuff already.
There are
a lot of places around the world where the populations are either coming close to reaching the capacity that their airport can provide or are beyond that capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not as simple as saying, well, why don't you just build another runway? Because sometimes there's just not any space to do that. You can't really add on to some existing airports. And then the other alternative is to build an additional airport.
Mm-hmm.
But there may not be any flat land near the city that's available for that.
Think about Japan.
That's a great example.
Japan has extremely densely populated cities, and it also there's not a lot of flat land
in
Japan.
Yeah, you got a lot of mountains.
And furthermore, when you start talking about building a second airport, then you're getting into that problem that we've discussed before on this show about adding more infrastructure problems rather than kind of doubling up with the infrastructure that you've already built.
Yeah. Well, and actually, and there's some cases where there's been discussion of creating a floating airport to completely replace an existing airport. So it's not even to just supplement what is already there. It may be
so that we could raise that parking lot and put up some more high-rise condos.
Yeah, yeah. Boy, Ponce City Market has really opened our eyes to the future, hasn't it? Okay, anyway, so land scarcity is obviously a big issue. That's probably reason number one why people have looked at floating airports. The idea that if you can't really find flat ground that is not already taken up by something else, what about any water that's nearby? You don't have to worry about flat ground there. If you can build something on water and make sure it's steady enough, then that could solve a lot of issues, depending on where the city is. Obviously, you kind of have to be near water, but a lot of our major population areas happen to be because I don't know if you noticed, but water is something that we need.
Also, trade routes having been what they were for a long time. Yes, seaports were kind of a thing.
Our city of Atlanta is kind of an exception because we were sort of a stop for a lot of different land routes along the eastern seaboard.
Our rivers are made of rails.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Atlanta used to be Terminus. It was the place where all these rail lines terminated. And so it's a little different. But most cities tend to be not too far from a coastal region, and that's where you could put something like a floating airport, obviously. Mm-hmm. Be a lot harder to do it in the mountains. So that's reason number one. Another reason, though, is the idea of cutting back on noise pollution. And it's not that an airport over the water would magically be more quiet. It's that there aren't as many people living on open water. So airplanes coming down and landing at an airport that's on open water, you wouldn't have as much noise pollution there because it wouldn't be affecting anybody. I mean, the noise would be there. It just wouldn't be affecting people.
Right. And that's more than just an annoyance. If you live in an area with heavy, continual noise pollution, like an airport, that puts adults at possible risk for hypertension and thus cardiovascular disease. And kids in that situation could be at risk for stuff like impaired reading comprehension and long-term memory, plus higher blood pressure. Again, so getting that kind of industry out of our neighborhoods could do real good for people.
Yeah, so there's some actual, like, positives that you can point at right away and say, All right. I can see why you would consider this, but there's some also potential negative impacts as well.
Doesn't sound cheap.
Super not cheap. I'm guessing uncheap.
Yeah.
If there's an opposite of cheap.
Yeah.
Oh, there is. It's expensive, and that's what this would be.
Yes.
But aside from the monetary thing, there's also environmental concerns.
Sure.
Because, you know, is taking a source of noise pollution and heat sink due to all that pavement and, you know, local land environment destruction and putting all that bad stuff smack into the middle of an ocean, is that good times? Is that worth it?
Yeah. And when we get into talking about specifics, I'll mention some of the stuff that various groups have said,
mm-hmm.
like, oh, the environmental impact would be minimal. I'm somewhat skeptical of that, at least in a few cases.
I'm pretty highly skeptical. I think that in general, when you're covering a few square miles of ocean space with something that didn't used to be there before,
there's probably going to be an environmental impact.
Some kind of impact. And oceans, as we have said before, are tricky. There's more ocean than truck.
You're so negative. So negative. No, absolutely. You're absolutely right.
But hey, but wait a minute. I've got a question.
Sure.
Okay. Don't we already have floating airports? Because I've seen pictures of aircraft carriers. It looks kind of like that's sort of what they are.
So, kind of, if you fly a fighter jet.
Exactly.
I do.
Do you? Wow.
Not.
I was about to say, I was learning so much more about Lauren today. So, yeah, it wasn't long after the invention of heavier-than-air aircraft that people started saying, huh, I wonder if you could put it on a boat.
Mm-hmm.
Brave pilots, some might say crazy, began to experiment with landing on and taking off from boats. In fact, the earliest aircraft carriers were converted merchant vessels,
mm-hmm.
where they built a flat deck on top of the existing boat's deck and then asked people to kind of try and take off from it or land on it. The earliest attempts, by the way, not 100% successful. But this developed over time, and you began to see actual ships dedicated from the design process all the way through construction to be an aircraft carrier. And so before World War II, we had dedicated aircraft carriers sailing around the ocean. In fact, I think the British had the earliest ones. Now, they tend to be relatively small compared to a commercial airport runway.
Mm-hmm.
The runways on aircraft carriers might be about 300 feet long, and they often use catapult systems. In fact, they all have some form of catapult system to propel a jet forward so that it gets the speed necessary to take off.
Mm-hmm. And also to catch them, kind of,
yeah,
when
they
land.
They've got a cabling system, uh-huh. where when the jet is landing, a hook catches a cable, and that helps the jet come to a stop instead of just rolling right off the other end of the aircraft carrier and into the ocean. So that's a very short runway. 300 feet is incredibly short. A medium-sized commercial aircraft requires a runway of 6,000 feet.
Oh.
So way bigger.
Oh, that's
20
more.
Times. 20 times longer.
Yeah.
And larger jets need even longer runways, like 8,000 feet. So what are you going
to
do?
The obvious solution here is to have passengers fly in Harrier jets.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Uh-huh.
That I'm in.
Might be a little expensive.
Yeah.
And you might be tying your luggage to the outside of the jet, but it would definitely be an exciting trip.
Will they still have Biscoff cookies?
And I don't know that you'd be holding on to your cookies in a Harrier jet, honestly. Although I've always wanted to fly in have an experience of being able to fly in one of those, either a stunt plane or a fighter jet type of thing. That's
if anyone has a hookup out there, call us.
Yeah, I'm still waiting on my hookup for a helicopter, but.
You mean a shorter vertical takeoff jet or just any fighter jet?
Really, any fighter jet. A vertical takeoff and landing jet would be super cool.
Yeah.
But really, any jet is what I'm talking about. But no, that's not really a practical solution, obviously. So if we wanted to build a floating airport, it would have to be of a significant length in order to meet the requirements of commercial aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And then also with aircraft carriers, the traditional kind, they have some problems with pitch and roll. I mean, obviously, if the swells are really, really big and the aircraft carrier is, in fact, moving, it makes it much more difficult to have a safe landing on that surface. And that might be a level of risk that could be acceptable in some military applications, but it wouldn't be acceptable in a commercial flight.
Sure.
So you have to have a surface that is going to be as steady as you can possibly make it. And that means you have to come up with an alternative to your classic aircraft carrier.
But people have done this, like we were saying before. Like, this is a thing that people have gotten through a number of planning stages for.
Yeah, yeah. We've even had a model made of this and had aircraft land and take off from such a model. That model would be one that was constructed in the mid-1990s. That's when a group of companies, mostly shipbuilders, got together in Tokyo to discuss the possibility of constructing what we now call very large floating structures, or VLFS, is.
Mm-hmm.
I love it when the word large is in any kind of acronym.
I like it when the word very gets in there.
Uh-huh.
Very large floating structures, thank you very much. And it was specifically for the purposes of an offshore airport, although they proposed other uses for such a structure as well. And they wanted it to float in Tokyo Bay, and so they formed what they called the Technological Research Association of Mega Float.
Mega Float.
Yeah, it's not a transformer, sadly. The
How
idea
can
was,
we be sure?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess it transformed from lots of smaller segments into a very big segment.
Yeah, because they built it out in sections.
Exactly.
Yeah, sort of out of tiles, almost.
Yeah, yeah. I think of like old Hot Wheels tracks where they snap together.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
It's kind of the same sort of idea. So each segment was pretty huge. It's 300 meters by 60 meters. And the overall length of the full airport, if they were to build the big thing, it would have been 5,000 meters long, and 4,000 meters would be runways.
So 5,000 meters long for our non-meter readers is about 3.1 miles. That's a big floating structure.
Yeah, yeah. And so the actual individual segments.
I just had a question.
Sure.
I never thought of this before. I don't know what the answer is. What is the largest floating structure ever created by humans?
That's an excellent question, and I don't know the answer either because I didn't think about it before we did this. But I would imagine it couldn't be much larger than that. For a floating structure, most of the floating structures I know about that are big are things like oil rigs.
Right.
And they're large, but they're not 3.1 miles in size large.
Right.
At least not the ones I'm aware of. In this case, the actual individual tiles themselves were big, 300 meters by 60 meters. Now, that means 300 meters, that's more than 300 yards, which means that these individual tiles were longer than three football fields laid down, you know, end to end.
Right.
And each of these segments were built on tanks that, you know, sealed tanks that allowed it to float. That's what created the buoyancy. And so you had these floating segments that then were towed into Tokyo Bay, snapped together. They had a series of clamps, Joe.
Nice.
And then welded together. They actually talked about how they had to, you know, there might be water in some chambers that would have to be pumped out. They'd then be welded and sealed together. And then ultimately you got this 1,000 meter long runway that was kind of the scale model for the overall airport. They hypothesized that due to the size of this structure, it would be so large that it would span multiple wave cycles. So, you know, ocean waves are physical waves, but they behave the same as other types of waves. And in fact, the idea was that this structure would be so large that the waves that would encounter the mega float would cancel each other out, so that you would not get a net movement mm-hmm. with the actual airport. You would only get a tiny little deflection, like a little deflective movement. Due to the waves, and it was referred to as the hydroelastic response, or just elastic response. Although in the report they said it was, quote, hardly noticeable, end quote. But to be fair, they said even though it was a minute amount of movement, they wanted to do extensive testing to make sure that this was not going to end up causing any, you know, issues, any safety concerns for aircraft. Obviously, that would be a flaw so great to cause them to completely abandon the project entirely. So they determined this probably isn't going to be a problem. We will test it to be absolutely sure. And they began to test this and said that everything seemed to go pretty well. However, it's not there anymore.
What happened?
Well, they tested it, and then the experiment was over, and then they dismantled it. I mean, again, it was only meant to be a model, like a 1,000-meter-long model.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to show that there were some interesting safety features here. They showed that the overall structure could remain buoyant even if one section suffered damage. They said if there were a catastrophic crash, and of course you hope that never happens, but if there were, then depending upon the level of damage, the structure should still remain fine. For one thing, if there was a fiery accident, most of that heat would dissipate into the air. It wouldn't transfer into the structure itself. The structure is made out of steel, which is pretty resilient stuff. If it cracked the top of the tanks, it should still remain fine. And if it even caused cracks all the way through the tanks to the bottom, it still would remain buoyant, assuming that it's damaged just one section, because the other sections would keep it floating. And so then you could send in repair crews to repair whatever the damage was and keep the whole structure safe as a result. They also talked about how, with it being segmented, if you're talking about like a massive damage where you need to replace a segment, it's more or less modular. So you could, in theory, do that. It would still, you know, the airport would have to go offline for a significant amount of time, but you could remove a segment and replace it with a new one if that was absolutely necessary.
Now, with a structure like this, I would be kind of worried about what might happen in the case of extreme weather events or...
Like a tsunami.
Exactly.
Or
a heavy storm.
Or an earthquake.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's supposed to be earthquake-proof, unlike a normal airport. So... not only earthquake-proof, but to the point where you could potentially continue to operate the airport in an earthquake situation. So you'd be able to have people landing and not just circling the city until, you know, an assessment can be made as to whether or not the airport is safe to land on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. And they even said that it could be tsunami-proof because it'd be far enough out in the bay where the swell of water would not be so great. They talked about how the swell of water gets the tallest as it approaches land.
Right.
And that it would be far enough out where it would be able to weather that without it having a significant impact on the movement of the airport itself. It would only be after it passed through where the airport had been moored off the coast of Tokyo that a tsunami wave would be large enough to start affecting people. And by then it had already passed where the airport was.
Uh-huh.
That is important to note that it is a structure that would be moored. It would be tied to essentially an anchor point or several anchor points.
So that it couldn't float away.
Right. Yes. You don't just have like, so have you been to the airport lately? I would have gone yesterday, but I don't know where it is now. Last I saw it was sailing toward China. Like that would be awkward. It has a mooring point where it would be anchored to the mainland. Or at least the rest of Japan in this case. So it was really interesting. Again, I don't know how much credence to give the report. It wasn't like this was an investigation by a third party.
Right.
That said, hey, we looked into this. We looked at their experiment. It all seems to be on the up and up. This was a report filed by the very entity that had an interest in having. And now, granted, I would imagine any entity that does have an interest in building this would want to be as transparent as possible, because if something were to go wrong,
mm-hmm.
that's a huge amount of accountability, right? Like, you wouldn't want to say, oh, yeah, this airport, it's going to work fine for you. I got to leave town, but this airport's going to be great for you guys.
Yeah, hopefully it wouldn't be like, yeah, we checked all the safety. Bring all your orphans and kittens out
right,
here. It's
right.
going to be great.
We're going to be just like, you know, fruit stands and big panes of glass and nuns, everything that, you know, you don't want to be involved in, like your basic car chase.
Yeah, why are you imagining a car chase?
Because I was just sitting there and thinking, like, all the things that automatically mean that you are going to see something really dangerous happen.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
You can just put that out there. Actually, to be fair, they even said that an alternate use for these structures
instead of an airport. Nunnery?
Well, no.
An open air market.
An emergency gathering place.
Oh, yeah, okay. Sure.
The idea that if there were, say, safe, a massive earthquake, mm-hmm. you could evacuate people, or you know there's a tsunami on the way, you could evacuate people to one of these very large floating structures where they would be out of harm's way for the duration of that event. Now, it may very well mean that there's still lots of work to be done afterward because the city itself could be, you know, very much affected by it. But the people, the human lives, could be saved. And you could make this an emergency response kind of situation. Even to the point where if you had constructed these pieces but had not yet deployed them, you could send them to a place where you know there's going to be a problem. And it could serve as like almost like an emergency raft for hundreds or thousands of people, which is kind of cool, really. And they also had a segment about the environmental impact. And here's where some more skepticism comes in. They said the environmental impact would be minimal. Really, the biggest thing it would impact would be phytoplankton, which would just move out of the way to a different area around the megastructure. And then the zooplankton would follow the phytoplankton.
And so on and so forth.
Fish would follow the zooplankton. Yeah, everything would be cool. And it's just floating. It's not like there's anything disturbing the seabed. So really you just...
Except for the mooring.
Yeah, well, but the mooring points exist anyway. It's just that the structure would be moored to an existing mooring point. Because you're talking about a big bay. But, I mean, you would literally be casting shade on the seafloor, you know. I like that you guys are just silently judging me.
I was waiting for Joe to react. Sometimes Joe's reactions are really beautiful. I'm so dubious about this thing, about that environmental impact part. But yeah, you know, I'm sure it's really just like the potential for chemical runoff.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you have jet fuel. You have exhaust from the planes.
Yeah, you've got oil that's going into places that oil goes into, all kinds of stuff.
On a flat surface that's on the ocean, right?
Yeah.
So then a heavy rain hits, there's going to be runoff.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean,
unless you have some kind of collective technology.
It needs a lip. It's like it needs to be like a rimmed baking pan.
Like a serious set of gutters.
Yeah, uh-huh. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and it's very possible that it incorporated something along those lines in order to do that, but I didn't come across that in any of my research.
I'd just be concerned. I'm like harping on this now, I feel like, but I'd be so concerned about all of that pavement that you use. Pavement absorbs heat. That heat goes somewhere. Is it distributed down into the water? Are we warming oceans further?
Well, I did read something about one of these floating. I can't remember which one. Maybe Jonathan, you'll recall that said, like, look, you know, even if there's a fire, this thing will be fine. It's just
that was gonna... Megafloat. They said that fire would be completely contained locally.
Well,
and
the structure would be fine. Are the fish chill about it?
I think they said it. According to them, again, it would just radiate upward, right?
Oh, okay.
Well, that's what they're saying was heat would dissipate in the air. But yeah. I mean, honestly, without seeing a third party investigation on this and seeing what the environmental impact is, I like you, Lauren. I feel that there's probably a larger impact than we are led to believe in the report.
I suppose that there could be some kind of thermal insulators to prevent any heat that happens on the top of the surface from bleeding down through the bottom of it.
And it's also possible that Tokyo Bay may already be an environment that is not the most conducive to life. But that doesn't mean we should make it worse.
Come on, let's go for Blinky the four-eyed fish.
But at any rate, so that was an experiment. And by 2000, they had dismantled it. They continued to analyze the data. But the mega float no longer exists. It's not in Tokyo Bay anymore. But there was talk of a sequel.
Yeah.
The Revenge Mega Float Returns.
Or Electric Boogaloo?
It was going to be called Mega Float 2.
Oh.
But so far it hasn't come together because it's modular.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Hasn't happened yet. But there was talk of doing it, so it may still happen at some point, but it hasn't happened since 2000. So, and yet there's still this need to increase that capacity for air travel. So it could be that it's revisited in the future.
Yeah.
But there have been
for
other
now, could we consider that talk scuttled?
Yeah, that idea has just sunk.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, guys. Do we have any other proposals to talk about?
Sure. Plenty. Yeah, the couple in San Diego. San Diego desperately needs another airport.
Yeah?
Yeah, so San Diego, you got a city, big city, Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
It's got an airport with one runway.
Oh, no.
That's very small.
Busiest runway in the United States because it's an international airport. You got a lot of flights that need to go in and out. A lot of flight delays because you've got the one runway to work with. And the city of San Diego has been struggling for a long time to figure out how to expand because it can't really, it doesn't have any space to build onto the existing airport, which means you need to build a second facility. And there aren't a whole lot of options. One of the options they were looking at would have required a military facility to relocate, which the city is not eager to see happen.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of money that goes into having a military facility there.
Sure.
So what do you do? Well, there are a couple of different groups that have proposed the floating airport option.
Right. Yeah.
So one of them actually dates all the way back to 1993, which that predates the mega float. Now, the reason I decided to say mega float first instead of San Diego is that the mega float, at least a model of mega float, was built.
Uh-huh.
No such luck with this approach. Mm-hmm. But in 1993... a company called Float Incorporated, suggested a very large floating structure using a technology they called the Pneumatic Stabilized Platform, or PSP, which sounds like you would have an airport on a bunch of like pistons, like pneumatic pistons that could automatically adjust the pitch and roll so that it would maintain a relative to the ground, it would look like it's staying flat, but relative to the ocean, it would just keep on making minute movements to stay stable.
This made sense to me once I read about what they had in mind for the buoyancy. So it was using the idea of trapped air.
Yeah.
Air trapped by the water, by the water pressure.
I was just thinking of pneumatic systems, and I was making it way more complicated than it really is. And in fact, their approach would be to have an airport resting on a collection of cylinders that are vertically aligned.
Okay.
With the bottom open so that you have this trapped air that's against the ocean and ocean surface. And it's the trapped air that is keeping the airport buoyant, floating. And when I saw that, I thought, oh, this is way more simple of a machine, which is good because the simpler a machine, the less likely it is to break down, right?
Sure.
You know, you don't want it to be too complicated.
And I would imagine that underwater pistons would run into a little bit of mechanical problems.
Probably.
At some point.
Yeah, at some point. there would be some maintenance issues sooner or later.
But no, this makes sense. If you're trying to picture this, just think of, I don't know, take a series of drinking cups, turn them upside down, put something on top of them, and then put them in the water.
To make it really fun, fill the drinking cups first, then empty them by drinking whatever it is you put in there, then turn them upside down and put them in water. Just making fun things to do.
And you're not allowed to go to the bathroom until you do.
This is the summer edition of Forward Thinking. No, but you're exactly right. That would be a way of making like a model of what this proposal was. So the airport itself would have floated about 3 miles off the tip of Point Loma in San Diego, and they wanted to call it Floatport. And it was going to be connected to the mainland via a tunnel that would empty out onto Interstate 8. The designers envisioned Floatport not just as an airport, but as a shipping facility. It would also be a mass transit hub for land, sea, and air. It's a very ambitious kind of plan. And they presented it to the city. And in 2003, San Diego formally rejected the proposal. They cited reasons including accessibility, safety, airfield configuration. That part they were saying the way the runways would be oriented would be in a north-south direction, and really it should be east-west for the best performance considering airflow.
Mm-hmm.
But if you did it east-west and you had it off the point off of Point Loma, then it would end up requiring aircraft to fly in very low over a lot of neighborhoods. Thus, you get that noise pollution again.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So you had this issue, like, well, if you do it north-south, pilots are going to have more trouble landing the aircraft, which is not good. And if you do it east-west, then you're going to create more noise pollution, which if your argument is that an offshore airport creates less noise pollution, you have invalidated that part of your support. The accessibility thing, they said, well, we're a little skeptical that you could create an underground or underwater tunnel to a floating structure that then attaches to the mainland. How do you do that in a way where if the structure can move but the tunnel can't move, there's an issue there. Like, what? How does that work? And even if you could get it to work, how expensive would that be? And how could you make sure that that structure would remain stable in all sorts of types of situations?
Mm-hmm.
And so there was just a ton of skepticism, not to mention the worry about the environmental impact. That was also an issue.
Mm-hmm. But all that skepticism did not stop another team from putting together a similar proposal a few years later.
Right. So this gets us up to 2009. And Adam England, who was an entertainment lawyer, also has a couple of IMDb credits to his name. He's appeared in a couple of films. No relation.
To Robert England?
No relation to Robert England.
Spelled the same way, though.
I looked it up. He is not related to Freddy Krueger.
Freddy Krueger would help make a lot of really great floating puns.
He could certainly make your dreams come true. So so he decided to pitch his own floating airport idea to San Diego.
Oh, this is the one with the good name.
Yeah. So he gathered together a group of collaborators and pitched the Oceanworks Offshore Airport. But the good name, I would argue, is his company.
Right. Can we spell this first, actually?
Sure,
because
sure.
I think it's funnier if you encounter it this way, because it took me like 4 seconds to get it, mm-hmm. and then I groaned audibly.
Right, because when you read it, you don't get the effect of the audible pun. So it's spelled
Euplotea.
And it's pronounced Euflotia.
Oh, I was thinking Euflotee.
Nope.
That's what I got, too.
Euflotia. It is actually pronounced Euflotia.
As in, like, utopia.
Yeah.
I'll take Euflotee, actually.
Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and GIF this.
Euflotee.
That's fair. I pronounce GIF as GIF. I'm not going to argue that you pronounce it Euflotee when it's clearly Euflotia. So their design was more than just an airport. It was a 4-story floating facility with an airport for a roof that could house any number of ventures, including hotels and restaurants, research facilities, and more, as long as you don't mind the noise of an aircraft landing on top of your house every couple of minutes for every day ever.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how they would have handled the noise issue for anyone in that facility. Like,
hand
how
out
do you
those earmuffs people wear at shooting ranges.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. And to be fair, this is a proposal that hasn't completely died. As far as I know, England is still pushing for it. The structure he proposed would be 3 square miles in surface area and have 2 runways. His plan called for it to be moored 10 miles off the coast of San Diego with underwater light rail connecting it to the mainland, or instead of underwater light rail, if that was deemed infeasible, going with high-speed ferries to just ship people back and forth from the mainland to the airport and so on and so forth. According to England, it would have been more than 200 million square feet of office space that would be available, which was actually more than what was available in the city of San Diego itself. So you could double the amount of office space if you made it all a big office facility. And the hope was that it would actually use renewable energy sources to power the whole thing, including generators that were using wave motions as well as wind power to create electricity. And it would also have a desalination plant to make fresh drinking water from seawater.
Oh.
So it incorporates a lot of stuff we've talked about here on Forward Thinking.
I think we've talked about desalination for San Diego specifically before.
Yeah.
Huh. Yep, we've talked about, and we've certainly talked about wind and wave power in previous episodes. So the idea is that this would be kind of the airport of the future that is self-sufficient, which is a pretty cool idea. Still a lot of big problems, big challenges, big questions, like what is the ecological impact of such a thing if you were to build it? Sure, it's generating power in a green way, but is it itself green, or would it be causing more harm just through its presence in the ocean?
Furthermore, this sounds not unambitious. How are you going to pay for this?
Yeah, so he was actually already in the process of raising money for a thing he didn't have clearance to build, but it was he figured it would be about $20 billion to build this thing. To me, that seems a little low, honestly, for a four-story floating airport that has two runways. $20 billion seems like it might actually be a little on the conservative side. But according to some estimates, San Diego could lose out on as much as $100 billion in economic growth if it doesn't expand its airport by 2020.
Huh.
So if it costs $20 billion and you argue, hey, we're going to be out $100 billion if we don't build something...
You're technically making $80 billion.
Yeah, you're at least saving yourself from an $80 billion loss, right? I mean, if in fact all of those things are true, that's a big if. The plan, not surprisingly, was met with a lot of opposition. One of the biggest problems is that there's no regulatory agency for very large floating structures. There's no law or agency to deal with that.
You don't know who to ask permission.
Right, exactly. Like there's not a light. You go to the license office, and there's not a window for very large floating structures. So you're kind of stuck. And as of 2013, at least, England was still working to get permission to build and operate what was then being called the Oplex 2020. Yeah, I don't name them. I just report on them. But yeah, I don't know if it's still like a living proposal that's being pushed in San Diego. If we have any fans in San Diego who are aware of this, I welcome you to get in touch with us and let us know. All the most recent stuff I could find was from a couple of years ago. Uh-huh. So mm-hmm. I don't know.
So it may have gone belly up.
Yeah. Yes.
It
might have been beached.
Yeah.
This one, more than even any of the others, just reminds me too much of Waterworld, honestly. Okay. Like, for some reason, something about it reminds me of Waterworld.
Well, to be fair, the desalination was for seawater and not for pee.
Well, how... I mean, can you pee in the seawater?
I mean, I have.
Will the station suspend people in cages over brine pits?
Almost certainly.
Okay.
At any rate, this was one of those things that when I saw it, I was like, I can't believe I've never heard of this. I mean, granted, I live on the other side of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like it's an issue that is in the forefront of my mind.
Have you ever flown into San Diego?
Yes, a couple of times. Hmm. It is an exciting flight out, let me tell you, because you fly out over the ocean. And when you're flying in, you're coming in over the ocean, so that's kind of terrifying.
Because
you don't land on the land side of it. You actually go out over the Pacific, sure. Turn back around, and then land on the landing strip. At least from memory, that's the way it is. I've flown in on the West Coast several times at several different airports, so I might be mixing this up. But as I recall, it was a pretty steep takeoff as well. I think for noise pollution purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I've flown in and out of San Diego a couple times. It's a lovely city, by the way. I highly recommend visiting it. It's one of my favorites in California.
Yeah, I've actually never been there.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, me neither.
Oh, man. Mexican food in San Diego is amazing.
Oh, I bet.
Phenomenal. But moving on to more floating airports, there's also been a couple of high-profile proposals in good old London. So
the Mexican food is probably not as good.
It is awful. I have had Mexican food in London, and it is... possibly the worst Mexican food I've ever had.
Aww.
It was also entertaining because I don't know if you know this. The people, the Brits, they like spicy, 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 melt your face off Indian food, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which actually, it's really, to be fair, is more like British colonial food.
Uh-huh.
But they love that. Yet their Mexican food was the most bland Mexican food I've ever had. Couldn't understand it.
Huh.
At any rate, another issue they have besides a lack of excellent Mexican restaurants in London is that...
Not enough pork lard, I'm guessing.
Probably not. Well, yeah, there's no shortage of pigs there. But Heathrow Airport is really overtaxed. I mean, big time. Mm-hmm. Super busy airport.
Oh, definitely.
And it's also enormous. It is not laid out in a very easy way. You have to take different trains. Like, if you land at Terminal 4 and you need to get to Terminal 2, you're going to be taking a couple of trains to get there, or a bus. It's not a simple layout. And there's not a whole lot of room for expansion, although Heathrow has petitioned to build another runway. It is not met with a lot of success. It's met with a lot of resistance because it's already... kind of an issue with residents about, you know, noise pollution. The same reasons we've talked about already.
Right.
So there have been a couple of proposals for an alternative airport. In one case, what would be a supplemental airport? In another case, what would be a complete replacement for Heathrow? Both of which have shared the same name. The first proposal was officially called the London Britannia Airport, and it had the political backing of then London Mayor Boris Johnson.
Oh, he's been in the news lately.
Oh boy, howdy has he.
Yep.
Especially, like, the day we record this is just after he has been named the UK Foreign Secretary in the wake of the UK leaving the European Union, or announcing its intention to leave the European Union.
And a great number of politicians leaving office.
Yes. Theresa May, the now new Prime Minister of the UK, came in and cleaned house. A couple of people resigned. A couple of people were sacked. And Boris Johnson was given the role of Foreign Secretary, and lots of jokes followed. Boris Johnson has not always been known as being the most diplomatic of diplomats, and yet now he has a diplomatic job. I'll tell you more about Boris Johnson after we're done with this episode. So at any rate, he had he threw a lot of support in for this idea of the London Britannia Airport, so much so that the locals began to refer to it as Boris Island. It was going to be this this airport built out on the estuary of the Thames, where the Thames meets the North Sea.
Right.
And the original one was going to be, I think, 30 miles outside of London, and was just going to be a relatively modest airport compared to the more recent proposal. It was going to be a four-runway airport.
Yeah, one thing I found interesting, just as a side note, is that the architecture firm behind this proposal for the London Britannia Airport was actually Gensler, who is the same firm that designed the Shanghai Tower that we talked about in our episode about skyscrapers and vertical cities.
Yeah, that's...
So they're sort of like, they seem out there in the forward-looking designs.
Right. If you want to get something that is kind of taking the risky approach, then... Gensler seems to be like the name in some of those really, you know, futuristic looking and sounding designs.
Mm-hmm.
So this one was formally rejected in 2014. And so it's kind of, I guess, dead in the water.
But it was replaced by an even weirder plan.
Yeah, which emerged in 2013. So the 2013 proposal comes out, the Airport Commission says no to the previous version, the four-runway version. And this one, also called the London Britannia Airport, so no confusion there, is a six-runway airport, so even larger than the previously announced proposal. But it would be built a bit further out in the estuary, 50 miles outside of London. And it actually... Originally, there were two different plans. The first plan was the idea of a real floating airport, but eventually they deemed that that was impractical because the waters of the estuary are relatively shallow and it would only really work in deeper water. So instead, they're talking about essentially building an artificial island and putting the airport on top of it. So
it would be Boris Island.
Yes, and wouldn't technically be a floating airport anymore. It'd be an airport that's out on the water, but it would be like on its own little island. Estimated costs are somewhere around $60 billion or more for this project. Now, they would connect the airport to the mainland through a bridge for vehicle traffic, as well as an underwater light rail system to go back to London. And since it's 50 miles, it'd be a bit of a trek if you landed there. And this would be an actual replacement for Heathrow. It's not, this would be like Heathrow would be shut down and reclaimed by the city, turned into something else. And this would become London's new primary airport. You'd still have Gatwick, I imagine. But yeah, kind of interesting. The fact that Heathrow is considered to be the worst airport in terms of noise pollution in all of Europe means that there's at least some support for an airport that would be out over the water where that noise pollution wouldn't be bothering the residents. And it would presumably improve the quality of life for a significant number of people living in London. So there's that argument. But a lot of people have said This is dependent upon a lot of factors that we can't be certain of, and we suspect that the bare minimum cost is going to be $60 billion. It may very well be that it balloons out of control once these other factors turn out to be stuff we didn't anticipate. Like, getting a nice stable base for the airport takes a lot more work than they had thought it would. That's a possibility. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we also have a lot more opposition, not just political opposition. Heathrow clearly opposes the idea. They're like, no, we don't like the idea of being replaced. Please stop. Give us another runway and stop talking about floating airports. And environmental agencies have also raised a lot of concerns. The World Wildlife Fund, for example.
To protect all of that precious life in the Thames estuary.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to sound dismissive.
Right. Well, you know, I don't know how rich and varied and biodiverse the life in the estuary is, but I figure it would be less so with a giant airport.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it is worth protecting.
So,
sorry for my jokes at the expense of the bounteous nature of the Thames.
The brine shrimp living inside the Thames estuary. So we may never see this come to pass. But again, we're getting into that real problem of these major cities having real issues at hitting capacity for their airports. And there's a need for more service, but there's a limit on the options. So it may come to be that within a decade or so, that floating airports in a few areas are a thing because they're the best of all the available options that are out there. Or maybe we'll see a switch to other types of fast travel that are not air travel, and that will reduce our reliance upon air travel. So let's say the Hyperloop becomes a more realistic option.
Yeah.
Then you could see that at least for certain types of travel, like domestic travel or travel between countries that are very close together, it might not be as frequent.
Or high-power ballistic passenger capsules.
You mean shooting people out of a cannon?
Maybe.
Okay. Well, I have one last one to talk about. This one is a little bit of a cheat because it's not a runway that's floating. It's a terminal that's floating.
Uh-huh.
So it's the place where people go to gather before and after they're on a plane, mm-hmm. not the place where planes take off and land, but still kind of cool. So back in 2014, the Ahmad Yani International Airport in Indonesia broke ground on an expansion that will include a floating terminal. So if it can operate safely, that might also give some credence to other people who want to try and pursue similar projects to expand or replace airports in other cities.
But if it doesn't include the runway, a floating terminal doesn't seem all that inherently different than a boat. A cruise ship or something.
And I actually like this idea. This is the idea out of all of this that kind of excites me, because I'm like, well, if we can have floating buildings to augment our cityscapes, that's rad. That's pretty okay.
Especially if it's acceptable to walk in and have like an old Sea Dog style accent whenever you walk into the building.
We're all into this. Yeah.
You know, instead of ringing a doorbell and saying, "Hey, how are you?" it'd be permission to come aboard. Permission granted. And then you eat sea biscuits and
get food poisoning.
Yeah, you get scurvy.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not all wine and roses, but you know, it's got its own panache, right? At any rate, this was one of those ideas that when I saw the article on CNN, I thought, I don't know how I've never heard of any of this. Because I love the retrofuturism of the Popular Mechanics piece. Mm-hmm. I think that the proposals, while I still have lots of questions about them, are interesting. I don't necessarily think that they are all realistic or pragmatic, but I love the creative thought that goes into trying to solve a very difficult and very real problem.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know that it's the right solution, but you know, it's definitely a creative one.
Yeah, I mean, it's another one of those things that airports are one of the uglier parts of what we do. I don't mean like morally uglier, but it's just kind of like they're not one of the most pleasant artifacts of human civilization, yet they're so incredibly necessary for the world to function as it does.
Mm-hmm. What's the nicest airport you've ever flown into? Because my answer might surprise you.
Nicest? I liked the Keflavik Airport in Iceland.
Oh.
It was nice. It was quaint.
Cool.
You know.
What about you, Lauren?
I'm very fond of Atlanta's airport.
Atlanta's airport's not bad.
It's really, I feel like it's well organized relatively for an airport, you know?
It's relatively easy to understand where you need to go, even if it takes a heck of a lot of walking to get there.
Right. There's one in the Midwest somewhere, either Detroit or Chicago, I want to say.
Detroit is phenomenal.
A lovely, like, light tunnel that you travel through. It's like being in, like, Willy Wonka's Tunnel of Terror, but better.
Detroit is my favorite airport.
Okay, maybe this is the one that I'm thinking of.
They have, like, super fancy, futuristic-looking bars there where it's, like the architecture is amazing. They have a light rail that takes you from one end of the terminal to the other.
That is what I'm thinking of.
Detroit is...
Oh, that's a great airport.
It surprised me because, I mean, I had never been to Detroit before, and I had all the stereotypical prejudice about Detroit. Went to the airport, thought, this is the best airport I've been in. The second best... is not because of the amenities, but just because of the charm, would be Kona, Hawaii, because it's all outdoors.
You walk
down a set of stairs from your airplane to the tarmac, and you walk
as our ancestors did.
Right, and it's all like the thatched roof kind of little pavilions that you walk into, so it's all outside. If the weather's nice, it's lovely, although the last time I flew out, it was pouring down rain. But, you know, who knows? Maybe in the future we'll say the nicest airport I've ever been in was off the coast of such and such. That'd be kind of cool. So, guys, if you have any questions, queries, you've got some comments about this concept, maybe, again, if you're in San Diego and you know more about the current status of that proposal, write us, let us know what you think. Our email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com, or you can always drop us a line on social media. On Twitter, we are fwthinking. If you search fwthinking in Facebook, our profile should pop right up. You can leave us a message there. We look forward to hearing from you, and we'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.